Audience, remember, going to continue this conversation, so head over to ecojusticeradio.org to hear the extended version. Thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you, Jessica.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore other shows, visit our website at ecojusticeradio.org and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Toxics Exposure, the Monsanto Roundup Trials and the Search for Justice. Thank you to our guest, Dr. Shadi Namhan, and always thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 and Adventures in Waste. Executive producer Jack Eye, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blakequake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, my name is Jeff, and I host a show entitled A Matter of Public Records that is broadcast on KBOO the second and fourth Saturdays of every month from 3 to 6 a.m. It is a somewhat eclectic show where the song choices are often instinctual, based on the prior song. Tune in and you might hear some instrumentals, some slightly avant-garde music, punk, post-punk, indie rock, jazz. To my ears, it is a classic late-night radio show. That's A Matter of Public Records, every second and fourth Saturday from 3 to 6 a.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
Where is the most radioactive site in the United States? If you guessed Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, you'd be wrong. The Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Richland, Washington, holds that dubious distinction. Established in 1943 as part of the Manhattan Project, it produced the plutonium used in the bombing of Nagasaki and went on to produce nuclear material for more than 60,000 weapons. During the race to develop nuclear weapons during World War II, safety and environmental concerns took a backseat to production. Now there are 177 underground tanks filled with radioactive waste that's leaking into the surrounding land and the Columbia River. The Department of Energy is tasked with cleaning up this site and is the biggest employer of people in nearby Richland, Washington. Tim Mulligan's supernatural horror graphic novel trilogy, Witchland, is set there. Tim, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much.
What's your connection to Richland?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Richland, Washington. My family's the same, so I have a long history of family there. My hometown, and I actually went back as an adult and actually practiced law there for a couple of years. So, and I have a long connection to the Tri-Cities and Richland, Washington.
The place sounds like it's got enough horrors without adding witches, ghosts, and radioactive bats. Why'd you add them?
Well, I mean, I started off going back to why I even started this project. I was during COVID, I was quarantining. I thought I would actually use that time in my spare time to do something I've always wanted to do, and that was to write a play and push myself to write a play. So I had an idea in my head. I do like darker and scarier things in that genre. And I felt like there was a missing niche there in plays that were scary. And I'm a big theater goer and theater junkie. So my goal was to write a play about my hometown. And when I grew up in Richland, there was always, you know, every town has its haunted houses and lore. But there was a house when I grew up in Richland, was told that this woman was a witch. And so it kind of terrorized myself and my small group of high school friends growing up there. And so I set up to write a play about it. I think to answer your question, my goal was to write a fun, scary play about my hometown and about this witch, but it just happens to be that it's set in this town where the Hanford nuclear reactor is. It all kind of blurred the lines of the supernatural scary story I was trying to tell with actually the real history of Hanford, which is real. My goal wasn't to do an expose on nuclear energy or what was happening at Hanford, but to write a story about my hometown, which is where the Hanford nuclear reactor is. That's just what I've done. And then I decided it did so well as a play that I would adapt it to a graphic novel format to get it in the hands of many other people who maybe didn't get a chance to see it on a live stage. And so that prompted me to now keep going because the response has been so great. And so I've written a series of books with the same characters, all based in Richland. And each book tells a different aspect of the Hanford nuclear reactor and its history. But I also weave in some sort of supernatural force as well, because that's what I like and that's what I gravitate towards.
A lot of people have died from the radioactive materials there, haven't they?
Yeah, there's a decades and decades and decades of troubled history there. The biggest story there is the story of the downwinder. There was about, I don't know the exact number, but 3,000 to 4,000 plaintiffs sued. Many people died. Many had thyroid problems or cancer problems. And it was due to release of nuclear waste that happened back in the early 50s. And the wind took it and blew it through all these farmlands. And a lot of people got sick. And it all kind of came to light in the 80s. Any of us who were born or raised there, have connections there, has someone in our family or life that was affected health-wise, either perished or got sick or had issues because of Hanford. So yes.
And wasn't there some deliberate releases of radiation too?
They called it the Green Run that happened back in 1950. And I've worked that in. Well, they were testing on, I don't know all the exact reasons why they did it, but they intentionally let this toxic waste out. And that's what the wind carried through a lot of Eastern Washington state.
In the second book in the trilogy, Snitchland, you focus on the whistleblowers at the site. What was going on with the whistleblowers?
The first story, Richland, was the tale of this family who moves to Richland, Washington during the COVID time. One of them worked there for a job. It's a beautiful place to live. It pays well to work out there. It's just that there's this nuclear plant that's there that has all this nuclear waste. So that told the story of the downwinders and the history of Hanford. In Richland, a situation happens based on a real life story that happened in 2017 where a tunnel collapsed and they found all these train cars buried in the ground that had nuclear waste in them, and someone met their demise in my book. There have been hundreds of worksite whistleblowers who have made complaints about safety concerns or health concerns or just standard workplace whistleblowing. And there's advocacy groups that exist in Eastern and Western Washington that are just lawyers or activists who are just there to support folks in their whistleblowing claims. And so there's several books out about this and a ton of history about the folks who have tried to shed light on what's happening out there. So in my book, Snitchland is more of a modern day based on some real life whistleblower situations, and it's a supernatural element. In this one, it's a ghost story, and it tells the story of many of the ghosts of Richland who have passed away out there, yet still might be walking around among the folks of Richland, and they passed away due to something related to Hanford. The second book, I tried to make more of a whistleblowing drama slash thriller about the workplace, an Aaron Brockovich type thing, where they're trying to bring these stories to light and they're focusing on this one story where somebody in this family died. But it also opens the door to all these other whistleblower stories that exist. And again, I wasn't trying to do like a historical expose, but it's just a real slice of life of what it's like living in that town.
One of the whistleblowers touches on the pressure to not only not say anything, but when she does, they start giving her psychological evaluations. That was part of the intimidation campaign.
I did a ton of research, and again, this was a fictional story, but based on real life whistleblowing tales. And I read so many one after another where, and I actually knew someone when I was an attorney who brought some things to me and thought their phone was being wiretapped and thought they're being followed and because they knew stuff. And so it's been going on out there for years that there's this kind of paranoia. But if you look at several of the whistleblower claims, many of them, when they bring forth complaints, they're going up against big government organizations or big corporations. And many times the response is to make the person sound a little off kilter. Maybe they're not all there. Maybe they need counseling. Maybe they're not all right mentally. That was based on many, many stories that I talked to people and read about. So yes.
There's a tunnel incident. You talked a little bit about that earlier. And this is where one of the characters contracts the cancer. The characters talk about it as the cancer, even though there's multiple different kinds. Is this based on a real incident?
When I say the cancer, most of the cases of folks who got sick out there had something to do with thyroid cancer. In fact, there are many, many claims of people who tried to join the class action suit, who my own family was included, and they didn't have the right kind of cancer. The sickness that most of the folks got there was a thyroid cancer. And so when I say the cancer, I grew up there, that's what we all just kind of said was the cancer, because that was what they're referring to. Unfortunately, it's kind of a morbid way of life. Like I said, there was a tunnel that collapsed. It was in 2017. I used that tunnel collapse as the impetus in Witchland for this guy who's working out there to get hurt. He keeps getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And you don't know if it's because if he was exposed to some toxic waste or was he cursed by a witch across the street, you know? So it's kind of a mix of environmental scares with some supernatural scares as well.
One of the characters is done in by beryllium dust. What is that?
I'm not the expert on all things nuclear waste, but I think it's dangerous out there. If you're exposed to the toxic waste, and that's what many of the folks who do have exposure and they get tested often for radiation, I think the beryllium dust is what that exposure could be. That's why you want to have protection on and gas masks and all that. But there are folks that get exposed and they get tested and sometimes they get sick.
In 2016, Ronan Farrow called the Hanford site an underground Chernobyl waiting to happen. They've spent billions trying to clean this place up. Do you have a feel for how is that cleanup going?
Well, it's a long, like you said, it's cost billions. It's a lot of different plans that have come around and then were either tested and shucked or moved forward. I don't know exactly where it's at now. I know that they're still trying to figure out. There's no secret that there's all this nuclear waste, like you referenced earlier, that are buried in the ground. And some of these tanks are old and some are reportedly leaking. And they don't want it to get into the river there, the Columbia and the dirt. So a lot of money and a lot of science is being put into it. And I think we all just obviously want the best and to come and have the solution be figured out and have a plan and have it be worked out and get that place all cleaned up. But it's estimated to take several more decades. And I don't think a solution is there yet. So it's been a long process. They quit producing plutonium back in like 86. It's been a long process, this cleanup, and they have a long ways to go.
Some of the isotopes, they're going to be dangerous for like 24,000 years, something like that. So it's got to be a pretty complex relationship between the people who live near there and work there and the site itself, because it's where most people get their livelihoods. But on the other hand, it's also the cause of many of their deaths.
Like I said before, I think people live there, they stay there, they move there because the jobs out at the site are plentiful. And look, the place is beautiful. There's wineries and the river and lots of sports-minded good schools. So there's all of that. But what's interesting to me is that the people who do live there don't like to talk about the dangers that are out there at Hanford. I think most folks just hope they don't get exposed to anything, hope it gets cleaned up. and they can put that to rest. But that is the main employer of people out there. It is the livelihood of most of that area.
And they recently started, I think like 5 or 6 years ago, you can take a tour of the place now.
Oh, yeah. You can take a full tour of the B reactor, of the reactors. There's a beautiful museum there. The Hanford Museum is doing a great job on. But you can take guided tours out there. I mean, I was just out there a few months ago for a family event, and I went up as close as I could to the reactor area and the labs and took a bunch of pictures. And you can get up there pretty close, and you can also take guided tours within the reactor.
Do you have any feel for how the cleanup is doing under the Trump regime? Did it get hit by DOGE?
It did. I heard that. I mean, it's in the news all over, especially up in, up there, that there are cuts. But you know, I know there's a mix between government roles there and then private industry roles. So I think more the government roles probably were affected, but I'm not an expert on that.
Let's talk a little bit about horror stories. Why do you think it is that we find horror stories so compelling? I was reading the trilogy and I got completely sucked in by the story. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. I think that if you look at the state of pop culture right now, and I am a huge consumer of all things pop culture, I think that the one genre, especially coming out of COVID, where I think the movie industry is really trying to come back to full swing, the one genre that keeps doing well is horror. People really like horror. And I think that whether it's through the streaming services or the movies or books, it's entertaining. It's not all good. I mean, everyone has their different facets of it. My favorite part of a horror story is a really great family drama or some sort of story that's there. And then you have these scary things happening around you. But at the heart of it is great characters and great writing and a great story. And I think people just gravitate towards that. It's fun. It's, you get a good horror story that also makes you gasp and make you laugh and get nervous and watch it with your friends. And it's just one that seems to be more popular than ever. Horror as a theater genre is getting more and more popular because people like, I think, this communal being in a theater together and being on edge and knowing you're going to have a fun time.
It's funny because real life is so scary now, and yet we're still drawn to these stories.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think there's a spectrum of horror. You know, there's slasher type things, which I don't really interest me, but some people really like that. Or there's psychological horror, which I do like. Or there's comedy horror, which is a mix of all that. So you kind of gravitate towards what you like. Just this year alone, if you look at some of the best movies that were released in 2025, critically acclaimed and money-making, these really smart, well-made horror. So I think it's one that people are really leaning into right now. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to feed with my Witchland series. The first book dealt with the history of Richland, but also with the witch and a witch story. The second book, Snitchland, was kind of modern day, like you mentioned, with the current day whistleblowers, but it was a full-on ghost story, and I tried to push myself to tell a ghost story. The third one, which the one that just came out, I really leaned into, let's make this just be super scary and dark, and that, but also kind of dealt with drug addiction in small towns, and that's Twitchland. I tried to write a vampire story, but it became more of a crazy nuclear waste as a drug story that kind of turned people into strange things. I've written two more that will be coming out next year, and they tell different aspects of Hanford. And I'm introducing, based on true history, I've done a ton of research on. So you still have the same troop of characters in the same setting, but I'm shedding light on different parts of living near that nuclear reactor and introducing different types of supernatural elements to it. So it's a different way of learning history. You learn about this time of this era or this place and real things that happened, but then you have this fun while doing it with the story.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest is Tim Mulligan, and we're talking about his graphic novel trilogy, Witchland. Any plans to have zombies coming out of there?
Just this summer, there's somewhere in the East Coast where there is rats or some kind of rodent. They got infected at a clear facility and they're running around these infected. And I'd heard of all these stories of animals in the past at Hanford. So, you know, there's a lot of bats out in the Tri-Cities. I remember seeing bats growing up. So what if some bats got into those tanks and they got infected and started biting people? So Twitchland's my attempt at doing something like a zombie slash vampire, pulling back the curtains on the small town drug problem.
A lot of rural United States was hit by the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
Is that part of what inspired the third book?
Yeah, I mean, I had just read, I'm always reading and soaking up history and trying to do research. And I happened to have just read about a big fentanyl bust that happened in Richland. I thought, that's my hometown. I can't believe that's even happening. And then I started thinking, how is that tied to the nuclear, the nuclear situation? So I come in and try to kind of bridge the two with these situations. So yeah, that did inspire me.
I'm sure the Richland Chamber of Commerce wouldn't endorse your books. Have you gotten any negative feedback from people who live in the area, or are people kind of taking it in the spirit that it's written?
I have a ton of friends and family there. And I think at first they're like, what are you trying to say about Richland with Richland? But then now the people read it and they see it's just they're fun. It's kind of a loving tribute to Hanford. It's not trying to crack open some big conspiracy issue. I'm trying to show that these characters are actually trying to really contribute to Richland society and live there. So now, first, I got some people in my circle, but now they got passed down. They can't wait for the next one.
The stories do have kind of a happy ending. In Snitchland, they get settlements and they're able to go on with their lives. And I'm sure that happens to a lot of people there, where even if they get sick, there's compensation.
Oh, there's been a lot of payouts, believe me. Yeah.
It kind of is a microcosm of a lot of what's going on in different parts of the United States, because we've got military bases, especially where there's a lot of contamination. Any plans to branch out from one disaster area to any others?
That's a great question. Not really. I have the three that are out right now, and the play Witchland has made the rounds. I played in New York for a while. Did really well. And I have two more books that I've written in the Witchland series. So, but I'm doing another project. I have a play that just went to New York this summer, and it's opening in Palm Springs this week, called Point Loma. It's actually based on a house here in Point Loma that I know that's kind of scary and haunted. So I'm just writing different things based on places that I know. I like to have a nugget of truth in the stories that I write, and then I kind of can go crazy with it.
Why a graphic novel?
I think many people have not read a graphic novel before, and so I get questions of, should I start reading a graphic novel now for the first time? Because many adults, I think, haven't ever touched a graphic novel, and I love graphic novels. I've always loved comics. Graphic novels is like kind of, to me, like the grown-up evolution of a comic. It's just a narrated novel. And so when I wanted to expand upon the Witchland accessibility, it just made sense. Like, this light bulb went off that this should be a graphic novel. It's dark, and it can lend itself well to some beautiful artwork, and I could tell the story of Richland and Witchland with, if I got the right partner, in which I found this great graphic artist to tell the story. And so now folks are discovering, if they haven't already, the graphic novels are a really fun way to read, and especially if you're a visual person and you want to see the characters and see what's going on. And so that's this world that I've fallen into. And luckily I partnered up with this great artist, like I mentioned, his name's Pyrink, and he does beautiful work. And so, yeah, I think it's just, for someone who hasn't done it, I'd say take a chance and read one, and then hopefully you'll get hooked and you'll keep reading them.
What's the difference between a graphic novel and a comic book?
Comic book typically is serialized. It's a paperback. It's one of a series. You'll get volume one, volume two, volume three, volume four. A graphic novel is bound. It's a bound novel that it's typically not part of a series. It could be, but it's a freestanding novel with illustrations to it.
Do you think that this is part of our culture where we are a lot more visual than we used to be because we have so much available as far as like videos and people don't read as much? Isn't the graphic novel kind of this hybrid between the old media and what we're looking at now?
I think so. I've published these three now, people tell me all the time that they don't read novels a lot, and that this is fun because they can read it at a quicker pace. And I think so. I think that, like, you look at my kids, for example, they unfortunately don't read like I did. I would read everything in sight, but they love, like you said, they're on their phones and they're on their computers and their laptops, and they like graphic novels because they can has the pictures and it holds their attention. And I think, you know, whether that's good or bad, I think that is saying something about our culture these days.
And it isn't quite the same time commitment reading a graphic novel that you have with a regular novel, because it does go pretty quick.
And if you like art, some of these stills in my books that my artist has done, I've blown up and I framed them. And it's just some beautiful graphics he's put together. So,
my guest has been Tim Mulligan, and we've been talking about his graphic novel trilogy, Witchland. Tim, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
Tim Mulligan's trilogy touches on some of the issues at Hanford, but the real horror story there doesn't need supernatural forces. The story of Hanford Downwinders is one of secrecy, sacrifice, and the long shadow of the Cold War. The U.S. built part of its nuclear arsenal there, and in the process exposed thousands of unsuspecting civilians to radioactive contamination. Hanford was established in 1943 as part of the Manhattan Project. At its peak, Hanford employed tens of thousands of workers. During the Cold War, Hanford continued producing plutonium on a massive scale, becoming one of the cornerstones of America's nuclear arsenal. But the work came at a cost. The rush to develop and stockpile nuclear weapons meant that safety and environmental health often took a backseat to production. Hanford's reactors and processing plants released large amounts of radioactive material into the environment, into the Columbia River, into the air, and into the soil. The most significant releases came in the 1940s and 1950s. One of the best-known incidents is the 1949 Green Run. That December, Hanford operators deliberately released a large cloud of radioactive iodine-131 into the atmosphere to test how U.S. Air Force planes might detect Soviet nuclear activity. Estimates suggest that the release was at least 8,000 curies, thousands of times greater than what would be legally allowed today. Unlike a single incident, routine operations at Hanford also contributed to ongoing contamination. Cooling water discharged into the Columbia carried radioactive isotopes, and venting from smokestacks carried others downwind. The people most affected were farmers, ranchers, small-town residents scattered across eastern Washington, northeastern Oregon, and parts of Idaho. Many of them had no idea they were being exposed. The term downwinders refers to civilians who lived in the path of Hanford's radioactive fallout. They ate locally produced milk, meat, and crops that absorbed iodine-131 and other isotopes. Children were especially vulnerable, as iodine concentrates in the thyroid gland. By the 1960s and 1970s, many downwinders began noticing clusters of illness. Thyroid disease, birth defects, autoimmune disorders, and cancers. Families who had lived healthy rural lives suddenly faced rare or aggressive illnesses that seemed out of place. Yet at the time, few drew a direct connection to Hanford. Government secrecy compounded the problem. The Atomic Energy Commission and later the Department of Energy tightly controlled information about Hanford's operations. Residents were reassured that the plant posed no danger, even while internal documents revealed awareness of significant releases. It wasn't until the 1980s, amid growing concerns about nuclear contamination across the country, that Hanford's history began to come out into the open. In 1986, the Department of Energy declassified thousands of documents detailing radioactive releases, including the Green Run. These revelations confirmed what many downwinders had long suspected. They had been used unknowingly as test subjects in the nuclear arms race. Lawsuits soon followed. Thousands of people filed claims against the government, alleging harm from Hanford's radiation. These legal battles dragged on for decades, with many claims dismissed for lack of proof, while others resulted in limited compensation. In the 1990s, the Center for Disease Control and the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center conducted studies on iodine-131 exposure from Hanford. The results confirmed that doses to some populations, especially children who drank fresh cow's milk, were significant enough to increase cancer risk. Still, the official compensation programs remained narrow and slow. Meanwhile, Hanford has shifted from production to cleanup. Since the 1980s, it's been the most expensive environmental remediation project in U.S. history. Billions of dollars have gone towards stabilizing waste tanks, cleaning contaminated soil, and preventing radioactive leakage into the Columbia River. Yet cleanup cannot erase the past. For many downwinders, the legacy is personal. Scars from surgeries, graves of loved ones, memories of government betrayal. Their story forces a reckoning with the hidden costs of national security. The Cold War arms race demanded sacrifices, but those sacrifices were not evenly borne. The history of the Hanford downwinders is not just about one nuclear site. It's a reminder of how secrecy and urgency can override safety, how government power can silence communities, and how the consequences of war and deterrence extend far beyond the battlefield. The downwinders' fight for recognition continues to shape debates about transparency, accountability, and justice in the nuclear age. Something to think about when they talk about building new nuclear plants in your backyard. You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic.